Thanks, Mr. Sanya. Yeah, thanks. I'm very happy to be here and be back in a place that's a real physics institute. I always felt like a renegade from physics, so I'm happy to be back. I gave a talk at Brookhaven recently, actually, for the first time in a physics place in many years, and it felt very good. So I want to try to talk a little bit like a realist today and talk about the way things are, and then a little bit at the end about the way physics or scientists might try to help them. Might try to help move things in the right direction. But by way of introduction, I lately see a lot of, every time I open the newspapers, I see a lot of extreme things and people taking extreme positions, both scientists and non-scientists and scientists and economists. And I was going to run through of them and then try to be a voice of reason in the middle of all of this. So, oh, here's my introduction. Okay, so I'm going to start, I didn't realize I had this, I'm going to start by, once I get through the next part, making some distinctions. I want to talk clearly about the difference between science, engineering, economics, and finance. Then I want to look at models in physics, which is where I grew up, and talk about the way theories and models behave over there. Then I want to try to switch over and talk about financial valuation models, pretty much the way they are as opposed to the way they should be, and talk about valuation in practice and the way people actually do valuation, for better or for worse, in the practitioner world. And lastly, I want to talk for about 10 minutes on how science might help some of this. Okay, so this is Richard Dawkins, a scientist on Saddam Hussein. It's one of my pet peeves here. You can read it. Imagine in fancy that some science fiction equivalent of Simon Wiesenthal built a time machine and traveled back to 1945 and returned to the present with a mantle called Adolf Hitler. What should we do with him? Execute him? No, 1,000 times no, etc. His argument is that Saddam Hussein is a prime specimen, that destroying Saddam Hussein and executing him instead of keeping him around for scientific investigation is a prime example of judicial destruction of research data. This is in the Los Angeles Times. You can Google it if you like. Then he says, what were the formative influences on these men? Was it something in their childhood that turned them bad, in their genes, etc.? Could the danger have been nipped in the bud by an alert psychiatrist? To me, this is a case of naive materialism, which I think we're all guilty of in various cases. And I think when we start out trying to fix the economic system or apply science, that we have to be very careful, because I think this is nonsense. There's no way that, and it seems to be the height of dangerous scientific speculation, to imagine that there's some simple causal scientific answer to Saddam Hussein's supposed evil by investigating him or shrinking him. By the way, one thing occurred to me listening to the talks this morning, thinking about Dawkins, who wrote The Selfish Gene, that I have a simple explanation for why the world is the way it is when people were talking about money and what's going on, and that's that you should think of dollar bills as genetic material, and they automatically flow to the people who will propagate them the most and reproduce them, which explains why rich people keep getting richer and why people who get poor but have the capacity to generate riches again will have the money come back to them very quickly. This is, on the other side, in my opinion, sort of not naive materialism, but naive immaterialism. There's a big tendency in finance to treat finance not as science, but as pure mathematics. And I found this a couple of days ago. This is supposedly the fundamental theorem of finance. You can try to read it and see if you can make sense of it. Security prices exclude arbitrage if and only if there exists a strictly positive value functional under the technical restrictions, et cetera, et cetera. It's sort of it looks not even like Euclid, it looks like set theory. And I find this a little sort of idiot savantish too. It's kind of dangerous in the sense there's a tendency more and more in schools to teach finance as though it were a branch of pure mathematics. And if you look up physics, which is tremendously efficacious, you can't find the fundamental theorem of physics, because physics doesn't have fundamental theorems. It's a practical system. And finance ought to be a practical system too, and it's a little weird that somebody thinks there's a fundamental theorem of finance. There might be a fundamental theorem of financial theory, perhaps, but there's a fundamental theorem of calculus and a fundamental theorem of algebra about factorizing polynomials. But it's a little strange to me that people are teaching physics, teaching finance in such an axiomatic way. I know actually when I was in physics, people used to, there was a tendency, I don't know how it is now, instead of teaching Maxwell's instead of teaching electrodynamics by starting with the inverse square law for Coulomb's law and Ampere's law, people would tend to just write down d mu f mu nu equals j nu, there was a book, and then derive everything from that. And it always seemed to me a little crazy to start by writing down something that general, maybe for a second course, but not for a first course. And there's been a big tendency in finance to get axiomatic in the same way too, which I think is kind of deplorable. And this is another example of craziness that is going on the other extreme. I think this is one example. Felix Salmon, who's a writer in Wired, says that David Lee's, there was an article about the formula that destroyed Wall Street. David Lee's Gaussian copulant formula will go down in history as instrumental in causing the unfathomable losses that brought the world financial system to its knees. There are also a lot of people attacking value at risk and all sorts of mathematical assumptions of naivete, but honestly, I don't think those are the things that are behind what's going on at present. They may play a small role in it, but they're not the cause, they're the tool. I don't think the Icelandic banks went bankrupt because they misestimated their value at risk, or that they relied on Gaussian distributions. To quote someone else I found on the internet, which I think is accurate, he said, "The decision makers are rich, powerful, kind of smart, do not feel embarrassed by their lack of knowledge in obscure technical trivia, and surely aren't intimidated by their lack of knowledge." I've worked a lot at banks and with risk managers, and I think I can attest to this, and it seems to me, in keeping with what most people said this morning, that what felled Wall Street, if Wall Street is felled, is not a formula, though that's one way to look at it maybe, but rather a good part of the familiar combination of excessive leverage, very distorted incentives, and the use of other people's money, all familiar age-old features of capitalist economy. And if physics is going to have some help in fixing some of this, it's got to be in some sense with the system and the interlinkings, not with formulas for estimating risk. It's the systemic, I'm going to come to this, but it's more the systemic complex stuff that needs fixing, whether in a simple way or whether in a complicated way. This, I think, is more realistic. I'm going to get through all my quotations. I see everybody else did this morning. This is Ben Stein in the New York Times. You can read it. I'd like to bring up one more little bijou about the economic crisis. I read that Lawrence Summers, wonderful guy, fine economist, forward Harvard president, high-ranking economic advisor, was paid about $5 million last year by a large hedge fund, D.E. Shaw. Of course, this phenomenon didn't begin with this administration. The last Treasury Secretary was the head honcho of Goldman Sachs and was paid hundreds of millions by it. I know people and I know money, at least the basics. If anyone thinks that a man who has had a taste of honey from Wall Street on that scale, and may I add that's not a very big scale, will ever really crack the whip on Wall Street, he's dreaming. Wall Street knows how to get its hooks into government. This is how the world works. Money talks. I think this is connected with what people were talking about this morning about, what was the word, captive regulators? I can't quite remember. Regulatory capture. And somebody else mentioned this morning too, but I'm repeating it. Whoops. Nope, I don't. Oh, yeah. So, okay, are we facing the second coming? This is William Butler Yeats. Kind of corny, but I think relevant. And everybody thinks, I noticed a lot of the speakers this morning hope that some revelation is at hand. And it would be nice, but it seems to me increasingly unlikely. This is on last Sunday's New York Times, which Nouriel Roubini mentioned this morning. The rest of the nation may be getting back to basics, but on Wall Street, paychecks still come with a golden promise, just as they did before the crisis. People are withholding at the same level as they did in 2007 for bonuses. So that's where we are right now. And what I want to try to do is since this was a conference about how science can possibly link up with economics, I want to describe, at least from my practitioner point of view, the practical state of finance right now and the way things work and where there might be openings or wedges for science to perhaps step in there. To me, science, I was arguing with somebody in the audience about this earlier, but to me, science is kind of reductive in the sense mechanics, electrodynamics, molecular biology, whatever they are, try to discover the fundamental principles that describe the world. And the way it does it, at least in my limited experience of reading about Dirac and Schrodinger and Heisenberg and Bohr and all the other famous physicists I grew up on, and in doing a little bit of physics myself, is that the scientific method consists of some sort of leapfrog between collecting data and observation and experimentation, and then occasional bursts of intuition and inspiration in formulating hypotheses or models or theories, and then going back to test them in a loop again, in a leapfrog with the experimentation. In science, for some strange reason, it in my experience, again, it pays to look at the surface and then to drop down deep to levels that you can only access by intuition or by some sort of analytic continuation from what you saw. If you look at Kepler, he looked at the motions of the planets and then essentially said the line from the sun to the planet sweeps out equal areas in equal times, which is a sort of explicit pictorial way of describing the law of conservation of angular momentum. And there's no way you can look at a planet and just see that. You have to have some sort of flash of intuition to be able to pose things that way. Similarly, when you get down to more sophisticated physics, Fermat or de Maupertuis guessed at the principle, or Lagrange, I'm not sure who guessed at the principle of least action, which is very deep and leads to Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics and dynamics. But again, these are things you can't look at the universe and say, oh, it's the law of least action, or oh, it's Q dot equals the H by dP. So somehow in physics, it really does pay to start from the surface or to start in the shallows, and then by intuition to go down to some deep level and write down something that you couldn't have really observed, and then see what it predicts for another part of the shallows that you can observe. Engineering, which is my second bullet point, is different. I want to come later to talking about what are the shallows in economics and what's the surface, because in physics it's kind of obvious, or it looks obvious as to what the surface is, namely mass, gases, pressure, volume, temperature, and the depths are atoms or things you can't see. In economics it's not quite that clear what's observable and what's concept. But I'll come back to that towards the end. Engineering is sort of different. And the field I'm technically in is financial engineering, which I'll come to. But engineering is much more constructive and is trying to build little machines which are essentially isolated little universes, almost isolated, loosely coupled universes that obey the laws of physics. And when you give them the right initial conditions, do what you want them to do, be they motor cars or levers or hammers in certain regimes. You can do engineering in a pragmatic sort of way by building bows and arrows or pea shooters or catapults, or you can do it in a much more sophisticated way based on real science by building transistors or integrated circuits or using quantum electrodynamics. And the two ways to get at it, one is based on theory and the other way is based on more heuristic practice. Mechanical engineering is concerned with building devices based on Newton's laws. Electrical engineering is based on building devices based on quantum electrodynamics and Maxwell's equations. Similarly for biological engineering, using whatever you know about molecular biology and biochemistry. Financial engineering is a little bit more complicated in the sense that you don't really, it has to be engineering based, there isn't a good science underneath it in the same way that there is a good science underneath physics. You don't have Newton's law or Maxwell's equations or quantum mechanics or the Schrödinger equation. You have a bunch of mathematical techniques that look very similar, but don't anyway have near the same efficacy. And in fact, the more formal they look, the less applicable they are. It's sort of strange when you look at finance journals that generally the more axiomatic they look, the less applicability they have in sort of inverse proportion compared to physics. And a lot of them look like, I grew up looking at axiomatic field theory papers once upon a time, and a lot of finance papers these days look like axiomatic field theory papers, as did that that early example I showed you. So financial engineering and economics is not going to have the same scientific basis, unfortunately, no matter what we do about it, that other branches of engineering have. I'm not going to talk much about economics, but I said it here, it's mostly engineering. I meant to say without science, engineering without science, not with science, and with a limited amount of empiricism. And finance is finally, from my point of view, mostly about valuation, taking account of time, money, and risk and their interrelationships. And you can't really do finance without models, like it or not. Even talking about the fourth quadrant is kind of a model about what is complex and what isn't. If I want to figure out how long it takes me to get from New York City to Waterloo, I have to have some sort of mental model of what's happening. There's no way to come up with a price for a mortgage without it, and you're always going to need models in finance. The problem is there are two classes of models. One set, which are mostly the ones that people in finance deal with, are models that operate in isolation, in which you give them input and you try to figure out what the value of something is. And then I don't think really physics is going to have much to add over there. Where there is really scope, where people talk about agent-based models and statistical mechanics and complexity. If there is hope at all, it's in looking at coupled systems and the fact that we have a lot of different systems that are interacting with each other, which aren't really modeled in any practical way in most of the financial applications. And when people use financial models, they tend to use the uncoupled ones and then do the coupling in their head by thinking about what the inputs should be and how they will behave in the future. So if there's going to be any hope, I think, for science coming in and somehow doing something useful and new in economics or in finance, it's going to be in somehow looking at interrelationships and coupling and phase transitions and coupled systems, but complexity. But it's not going to be easy. As somebody else said this morning, the history of people on who look at this stuff, they've lived through AI and they've lived through chaos and they've lived through chaos theory and they've lived through talking about complexity. And so far, nothing useful has come out of it yet. That's not to say it won't, but there've been a lot of false hopes. I want to try to talk now a little bit about, probably most of you, a lot of you haven't been in finance, and I want to describe, I don't want to say the state of the art, but the state of the way things work in comparison with physics. So let me start with physics first, which I think I understand. And in physics, there's sort of two ways of explaining the world, and I loosely separate them into theories, which is the top one, and models, which is the second one. And from my point of view, theories have two essential things. They have dynamics and they have causality. Dynamics meaning they tell you that force equals mass times acceleration, for example, with Newton, which is the causality, but the dynamics is that the force is the product of the masses divided by the distance between them squared. And one tells you the force, the other one tells you how things evolve into the future. And I think what characterizes a theory is not so much the equations, but the level of aspiration, in the sense that theories are ambitious and try to imagine that they're a little bit like Moses coming down from the mountain and saying, these are the Ten Commandments, this is the way the world works. Maybe Newton's laws aren't exactly right, but I think people who write down these kind of things believe that they're discovering some kind of truth from a psychological point of view. And when you get a really good theory that's good to, you know, 8 decimal places or 10 decimal places, like quantum electrodynamics, it's hard to distinguish the theory from the universe itself. In some sense, there isn't much of a gap between them at all. And the other thing I want to say is theories, all of these theories are kind of absolute in the sense they tell you this is how things are, irrespective of where you start from. Models are sort of a different story. And what I want to say later is in finance, at least at this point, there really are no theories. There are only models. Models are what I used to call in physics or in particle physics, phenomenological models, or which are really just metaphors. Models say, if you want to understand this particular part of some part of the physical universe, you can think of it as being a lot like some other part you already understand from a theoretical point of view, but it's not exactly equivalent to it, it's analogous to it. So you can also use phenomenological models to make predictions. They may also have dynamics and they may also have causality, but somehow there's something toy-like about them. You don't really believe that that's the way the world is. What you're saying more is this is a good way to think about the world for a limited range of regimes and for a limited period of time. And so models as opposed to theories are really models of relative value. They say, if you understand this thing, you can try to understand this other thing. If you understand this thing from an absolute point of view, you can try to understand this other thing from a relative point of view by comparing it to it. A good example for me, for having been in physics, is sort of the liquid drop model of the nucleus, where you know a nucleus is really made out of protons and neutrons attracted by the strong force, or nowadays quarks attracted by gluons, etc. But even at a more reductionist level, although you know it's composed of protons and neutrons, nevertheless you say, I can probably model it as a vibrating, oscillating ball with a certain density that has normal modes and vibrations and excitations. And if I calibrate that using the semi-empirical mass formula to what I know about nuclei and what I see, I can then try to calculate other things that I haven't seen and try to predict excitations or resonances. And you have to calibrate the model to first fit the coefficients of various terms to fit what you know, and then you try to predict the things you don't know. But you wouldn't claim it's true in the sense that Newton's laws or special relativity or general relativity or quantum electrodynamics are true. It's clearly an analogy that's going to break down at some point. Financial models are really are really different. Physics models, I meant to say this earlier, in one sense, they aim at divination, to try to predict what's going to happen in the future and control it. So you can shoot rockets to the moon or launch rockets over Japan if you can manage it. Financial valuation models really, for the most part, despite everybody's misconceptions, don't aim to predict the future in practice. What they really aim to do, at least if you work practically with this stuff, is try to figure out how to interpolate for them. So what financial models do is say, they relative value models, or they metaphors. They say, you give me the price of a bunch of things that are liquid that I can look up in the market and see their recent traded price, and I will tell you the value via the model of something that's illiquid whose price you don't know. So to give an example, you could imagine being in the New York real estate market and deciding that you'd like to buy a penthouse on Park Avenue on the 24th floor or somewhere on 83rd Street. And there aren't many penthouses, there's not a liquid market supposedly, and all you really know is the price of one bedroom or studio apartments in Battery Park City, which were pretty liquid until recently. And so now somebody says to you, figure out what you should pay for an apartment in Park Avenue, and if you're kind of rational, I'm making this up, but what you would do is say, okay, tell me the price per square foot of the apartment in Battery Park City. It's 800 square feet, it's $100 or $1,000, whatever it is per square foot, or $2,000 per square foot, and now I'll extrapolate that to Park Avenue. And you don't really think that the price per square foot is a constant. You don't really think that the price per square foot is exactly what it costs you to build it. It's just putting everything you know about the apartment into quoting it as price per square foot. And it's an implied variable that says, if price per square foot was the important thing, how much would you pay per square foot? And then you use that to extrapolate to a bigger apartment, and that's your first order guess. And then you say, okay, well, Park Avenue is a better location, and there are better schools, and there are 24 doormen, and there's 24-hour service, and I'm near the park, so I'm going to add a whole bunch of extra corrections for, in a practical sort of heuristic way, for the fact that this isn't really a perfect model. I think that's the way most models work in finance. They start by calibration, meaning taking something that's a metaphor and calibrating it to something you know, like the Battery Park apartment, and backing out some implied variable, which is the price per square foot. It's not the real price per square foot, it's the quoted price per square foot. It's not what it costs you to build it. And then you use that to extrapolate. It's kind of a dangerous process, because if your model isn't accurate, or if your model isn't realistic, then you're backing out an implied variable. It's like inverse scattering. If you shoot electrons, all of this is really like inverse scattering. If you shoot electrons off a proton and try to figure out the proton form factor, or whether they're quarks inside, in the same way here, you're trying to look at one set of financial devices and figure out what the interior structure is and use that to calculate something else. But it's sort of dangerous if your model fundamentally breaks down. So if your model's wrong, you're getting false information about the underlying variables because you don't have all the underlying variables, and it's dangerous to extrapolate by it. But either way, most of the time, you're not predicting what the price per square foot will be in the future. You're saying, what's the right price per square foot for today for me to use, from going from something whose value I know to something whose value I don't know. And I want to separate that from economic forecasting, which is trying to say what the price per square foot will be a year or 10 years from today, or a month from today. How much time do I still have? 15 minutes? Okay, that's good. So in physics, there are lots of laws, as I said. There's Newton's laws, there's the principle of least action, which leads to it. There's quantum electrodynamics, there's gravitational theory. All of these are fairly solid laws. There aren't really a lot of laws in finance, and the stuff Eric was talking about in terms of trying to find some more fundamental laws, I think is praiseworthy. I don't think anybody's found it yet, and I can't quite decide how feasible or unfeasible I think it is. But the only practical law that people really make use of in the practitioner world in finance is really the law of metaphor, or the law of similarity, or the law of one price, which essentially says that or the law of no arbitrage, if you want to use fancy words, which says that if you want to estimate the value of a target security, which is just what I described, like that apartment on Park Avenue, If you want to estimate the value of a target security, which is illiquid, use the price of a replicating portfolio of securities, which taken together behave similarly under all circumstances. So that says you want to know what something complicated is worth, see if you can make it out of simple things, and simple things whose prices you already know, where you can also compute the cost of manufacture. You want to know what fruit salad costs, figure out how much fruit costs and how much it costs you to can it and transport it. Or sometimes inversely, if you want to know what the right price for peaches is, figure out how much fruit salad costs and subtract off the price of all the other ingredients in the fruit salad except the peaches themselves, and that's the implied price of peaches. And most of finance goes back and forth in this kind of way via model. Everybody calls this replication, and everybody who's sensible understands that it's a very faulty process or a very error-prone process. And so if you're sensible, you try to do it with as few, in a way related to what Nassim said, you try to make as few assumptions as possible. So if you can replicate perfectly, meaning if you can, for those of you who know finance, if you can make a a forward out of a long a stock, short a bond, and there's absolutely no model dependence at all, or if you can put a call and a put together to make a forward, and there's absolutely no dependence, the payoffs are the same no matter what the world does or no matter what the laws of the world are, as long as your creditors don't default, then that's model independent, and that's the best way to value things. And people call that sort of static hedging or static replication, and it needs little assumptions and little resources in the way of information technology or models. If you can't do that, the big discovery of Black-Scholes and Merton, and it's a platonic discovery in that the real world doesn't exactly behave that way, is that you can sometimes put together much more complicated dynamic ways of creating or replicating securities you don't know via securities whose prices you do know. So you can replicate, under theoretical circumstances, you can replicate an option out of dynamically trading stocks and bonds if you make enough assumptions about the smoothness of markets and about volatility. But it needs much greater resources, both from a modeling point of view and from an assumption point of view, and from a literally living everyday point of view. You need quantitative people and IT people and market feeds and lots of computation. And I like to think of this as really, as I said, a sophisticated form of interpolation. You're going from liquid instruments whose prices you know to illiquid instruments whose prices you don't know, and you're interpolating. It's better than cubic spline interpolation or straight line interpolation because you have some idea of some dynamics underneath which might be reasonable to base it all on, but you also have to remember that the world is more complicated than the model that you're building. The tricky part in most evaluation is really in the mathematics is specifying what you mean by under all circumstances. And you're trying to say that these two securities will behave the same no matter what happens in the future. And when you try to specify the future, it's complicated. It always reminds me of a movie I saw when I was studying for my qualifying exams, which was called Bedazzled with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore a long time ago. And it's a story of a short order cook in London who sells his soul to the devil, who's Peter Cook, in exchange for 7 chances to seduce the waitress that he works with. And he sells his soul and he gets his 7 chances. And the first thing he does, the devil says to him, is, so what do you want? And he says, I want to be with her in a quiet place where I'm in love with her and she's in love with me. And we're both rich. And the devil snaps his fingers and they're somewhere in a castle in Oxford over a billiard table and they're in love with each other. But she's actually married to the owner of the castle and he's just a guest. She's got high principles. So it doesn't work out. And so he suddenly goes through 7 other scenarios, and eventually in the last one, he asks for them to be alone together in a quiet place with nobody around at all, and they both end up being nuns in a Trappist monastery. So a lot of getting all circumstances right is like that. You can't really specify what the world is going to be like, and so all of your replication doesn't work perfectly. The engineering is trying to do the replication under the circumstances that you define. I'm going to try to finish off by commenting on where in all of this people might be able to stick some scientific method and some scientific insight into this. So let me try to go through. So I'm trying to make as many bullet points as I could think of. The trouble with all the models that I've described so far, and they're practical ones, is that they really omit taking into account the coupling between individual pricing models or individual valuation models and the way the whole world as a whole behaves and the interaction between different banks and different financial entities and different agents. And it's not because the people who use them are necessarily stupid, although some of them may be. They're assuming an infinite market with a big reservoir with no liquidity problems and no radiation reaction or no quantum fluctuations in whatever language you want to talk about it with the vacuum. But they're ignoring liquidity, they're ignoring crises, they're ignoring pandemics and contagion. But they're not ignoring them in their head. They're ignoring them, or if they're smart, they're not ignoring them in their head. They're ignoring them in the model, and it's their overlay of common sense or thinking about the inputs into the model that try to take account of the complexity of life and the feedback. And I think maybe this is somewhere where physicists' experience with many-body systems, phase transitions, non-equilibrium physics can help. But as I said, you have to be careful and be kind of humble, because people and societies really aren't amenable to the same sorts of modeling that inanimate systems are. And I think, for example, of Leontief's input-output approach, for which he got the Nobel Prize, which is a sort of ambitious econometric attempt to relate a lot of different inputs to a lot of different outputs, but ultimately isn't really practical because the equations probably aren't stable, and also the econometrics isn't stable, and also dealing with a 100 by 100 matrix just isn't a reasonable way of figuring out what will happen. Things get chaotic. So let me mention a bunch of things that I think are relevant to trying to apply science to this whole area. The worst one for me is that the relevant variables are human and mental. In physics, you can talk about mass and charge and space and time, and I don't know, there may be something subjective about them. When I think about quantum mechanics and I think about the fact that there's a wave equation that describes probability, and I remind myself that the only way to define probability is as the limit of some, if you do it the numerical way, as the limit of some as the ratio of some infinite number of trials of the events you get to the events you don't get. It's so clearly a mental concept that it sort of stuns me a little bit that there's an equation out there in the world or in the universe that describes probability, and I don't really believe probability would exist without people. But maybe the same is true of mass, but it doesn't seem so obvious. But when you start coming to economics and you talk about default rates, volatilities, interest rates, these are all things that clearly don't exist without human beings, and All of your variables are now human mental concepts, and the mental's just as real as the physical. And I don't quite know how you tackle this, but you have to be aware of it all of the time. And that's where I sort of get worried about, or not worried, but a little skeptical about applying deep theory to all of this, where what you're dealing with is ultimately people's perceptions about the future. Secondly, there's something funny about time, in that time tends to run, at least in the models I've been talking about, time in physics runs forward. You start with present initial conditions, and you try to forecast the future. In finance, at least in the models I've talked about, time tends to run backwards. Jeremy Bernstein, actually, who's a physicist, once pointed this out to me. I hadn't quite realized it. But what you're doing is, when you calibrate models, you're putting in some stochastic process for the way the world might behave in the future, and then you're constraining it to match today's prices. And so you're constraining. You're not predicting future behavior, you're constraining it, and you're saying this is the way it has to be if that's what the yield curve is today, and then you're running backwards in time to value other instruments. So you're never really forecasting in that sense. You're constraining the future rather than predicting it. Thirdly, there's this whole, related to the first thing I said, there's this sort of, it always reminds me of this kid's song about there's a hole in the bucket and you want to fix it, and in order to fix it you need a straw, and to put a straw in the bucket you need an axe, and to sharpen the axe you need water. And to get water, you need a bucket. So it's kind of the same thing with this whole view of the future. If you, in order to figure out what the fair value of a security is today, that depends on its future cash flows under all scenarios. In order to figure out its future cash flows, you have to figure out what the economy or what the future is going to be like. In order to figure out what the future, how the future is going to be, depends on how people behave today, and how people behave today depends on what they assumed about the future in order to value their securities. So you go around in this complete circle in which everything you think about the future affects how you're going to behave about it, and very difficult to figure out a way out of this. Maybe it's related to this path dependency that people were talking about. In a similar way, you can do physics because I said a lot of the experiments that you can do are sort of loosely coupled to the rest of the universe. If you flip a coin, It really doesn't matter too much whether there's a small wind in the room or where you're situated on the planet, you still pretty much get 50-50 for a fair coin, because you can decouple the experiment. Or if you scatter atoms, it doesn't matter, scatter electrons, it doesn't matter whether you do it at CERN or whether at Fermilab, you can recreate the same electron over and over again to do the experiment and look at the statistical distribution. If you want to do that with finance, you really can't isolate, it's like history, you really can't isolate the economy from some part of the economy from the rest of the economy in a realistic way, except by doing experiments on students for sums of money that don't really matter to them. So you're kind of stuck. And you can see this sort of with the way people mentioned this morning trying to fix the credit crisis, in the sense part of what caused the credit crisis is the fact that there was easy credit, and the initial conditions are different now, so people hope to fix the same thing by giving you easy credit. But the cure, if the cure is also going to be the cause of the problem, then there's something wrong. There's some hysteresis in there, which there isn't in repeatable physics experiments. A couple of other points I wanted to make. It's better to have dynamical models than statistical models. Statistics, everybody just loosely says causality isn't the same as correlation. And it's true. And the good thing about dynamical models, even Black-Scholes, which is an engineering hedging model, is that it lets you see exactly what you're assuming. If you have a statistical or econometric model, in the end, you don't know what you're assuming except the statistics or the regression. If you have a dynamical model where you actually have some cause and effect, and you're constructing something like Black-Scholes, for example, you know what you're ignoring. And I'm not saying the model is right, but it's a good model in the sense you're always sweeping dirt under the rug in a model, but you know what you're sweeping away. The danger is when you don't really know what you're ignoring at all. And so I have a liking for physics-style models rather than econometric models, because dynamics is what counts in the end. Another remark I wanted to make, though, and it's sort of contradictory, is the second last bullet, is that good models, in the sense of usable models, have to be kind of vulgar, in the sense you're dealing with markets, and markets are run by people who are kind of vulgar, and they deal with simple things. And you have to kind of be vulgar, but in a sophisticated way, and I'll explain what I mean. The level of vulgarity gets more sophisticated every year, but it's still vulgar in the sense that you want your models to address things that everybody talks about. So good models in finance are sort of market models where the things they talk about are the things that the model talks about are things that people use every day. This is related to what I was saying in the last bullet point, in that in physics, I think it really does pay to drop down deep and talk about things you can't see, to observe things on the shallows, drop down deep, talk about things you can't see, and then come back up to predict other things you can see. If you look at the analog of some model, which I've written over here, which is the Heston model for stochastic volatility in finance, it writes down a complicated stochastic process for stock price evolution in the top line and volatility evolution in the second line and a correlation between them. And it's a kind of noble attempt at writing down something about the behavior of stock prices, which is better than geometric Brownian motion. But you also look at it and you say to yourself, how can anything like this possibly be true? You know, if you're a physicist and you write down, I don't know, if you're a physicist and you take a shot at writing down some model for superconductivity or general relativity, somewhere in your heart you say, there's a chance I might be right because Schrödinger or Einstein or I don't know who else, or Feynman or Gell-Mann actually managed to discover something fundamental by thinking. But nobody ever wrote down anything in economics that ultimately ends up being true in the same sense. And so if you're kind of honest, your heart sinks as soon as you write down something like this and you say, there isn't a hope in hell that I'm actually right, I'm just pretending temporarily. I also wanted to say you have to think carefully about what's observable and what's unobservable. In physics, it looks kind of clear. You start from gases and solids, and then you do thermodynamics, and then Gibbs comes along, and Maxwell, and they do statistical mechanics and figure out the existence of atoms consistent with the behavior of gases, and you kind of know that the macroscopic is what you see, and the microscopic is what you deduce as concepts, meaning atoms or electrons, or and explain the macroscopic. It's kind of tougher with markets, I think, because I'm honestly not sure what's the observable and what's the concept. In the sense, you've kind of got observables and concepts at both ends of the spectrum. For a start, the agents. If you introspect, agents are the observables, and so the small scale stuff you talk about is really what you see. People know how they feel more or less and how they behave. On the other hand, people also talk about markets as though they're the observables at the large scale. And I'm not really sure, nor am I sure that anybody else is sure, what's actually where you should start. Should you start with the macroscopic or the microscopic? Economists have tend to start with agents and build their way up to markets, and I'm not sure I like that. In the last few years, there's been a lot of interesting work done by econophysicists around Eugene Stanley at Boston University and Don Farmer, all looking at, from a statistical point of view at the Santa Fe Institute, from a statistical point of view of looking at macroscopic behavior of markets or returns and trying to understand them better. And I think that's probably the right way to go about it. But the economic world hasn't been, the financial world hasn't tended to look at this very much. 5 minutes? Okay, I'll be done in 5 minutes. I'll be done in less. Other thing I wanted to say is, these are all somewhat connected but random thoughts, is you have to accept that the complementarity of explanations. I think Nassim was saying over here this morning that if you have a model that predicts how the market behaves, that's not the case, because it's really all due to supply and demand. And I think those are complementary things rather than competing things. There's a nice illustration in the book by Doug Hofstadter on computing, where he says if you build a toy computer out of dominoes to figure out whether some number is a prime number, and you set up the dominoes that when you flip the first one, it knocks the others down, and if it knocks them down, the number is prime, and somebody says to you at the end, why did the dominoes fall? And one answer is because all the other ones pushed them down, but the other answer is because the number is prime. And there are two ways of looking at the same thing. And I think in the same way, I've seen people when I've worked on models, and I used to work on a model that said when the market goes down, volatility goes up. And I used to see it happen sometimes, and I said to one of the traders, you see, the market went down yesterday and volatility went up today, implied volatility. And he said to me, no, that's not the case. It's just because IBM came in and bought puts to protect themselves, as though that were a counterexample to what I was saying. But those two things are perfectly consistent, so you have to allow for explanation at different levels. Okay, I'm going to jump ahead to optimization. I think optimization is often pointless in building all of these models, because you're dealing with human variables that are projections into the future. And if you want to use your GPS system to figure out the best way from here to Toronto, that's fine, because the length of the roads are not going to change when you start driving. But if you want to use a mean variance optimization to figure out what's the best portfolio to buy, it's kind of nonsense at some level, because all your assumptions about mean and variance are not going to be true in the end. So you're much better averaging than optimizing. Okay, I'm going to wrap up. So what I'm saying is I'm not, the scope, I think, for science getting in here is not in the models of individual pricing, but in trying to either, perhaps, as Eric said, find some deeper way of understanding this, which I think is going to be very difficult because you're dealing with people and their concepts, or trying to build network agent approaches of understanding where people start to become unstable by virtue of their interactions with each other or different firms. But I think you have to keep in the back of your mind that all of these models are really Gedanken experiments in the physics sense, or even worse, they're Gedanken models, in that none of them, as Eric said this morning, none of them, you have to resign yourself to failure before you start, and none of these models are really going to be right or correct. They're only going to be approximate sort of metaphors that you can use for a while, that you're trying to shoehorn a much more complicated world into a limited model. You're not going to find I don't think you're going to find the Schrodinger equation of finance, but I hope to be proved wrong. And so you have to keep in mind sort of the dangers of idolatry, as I like to call it, imagining that your equations are going to describe the world around you, or at least the animate world around you. And I think the first step in dealing with the current crisis, there may be a role for fancy physics and fancy theory, but the first step is going to be at an engineering level, at regulation, and using heuristic things like bow and arrows rather than quantum electrodynamics and solid-state physics, for which there may be a role, but a little bit down the line. Thanks. Come on, time, I think so.